So this is a SWAC podcast, and I'm back today with another special guest, Latin American Studies and Human Rights, double major at UConn, an activist and an advocate in her communities. Jocelyn, how are you doing?
Good, how are you doing?
I'm good. So for those who kind of don't know you and want to know about your story, can you kind of speak about your upbringing?
Upbringing in...
like how you grew up, where you grew up. Let's start where you grew up.
No, that's true. So I migrated from Mexico when I was 8 months in 1998. I was only, a baby. I was 8 months old, and my parents both were going through a lot in Mexico, economically, financially, and other issues as well. They both didn't go to college. My father dropped out of middle school to sustain and help his family. And my mom didn't continue college after high school. And so they didn't want that for me. So they, decided that they would just leave. And so we crossed the border. I was a baby, so I don't remember anything of that. But it was, it happened. And we got to Arizona and took a plane to Connecticut because my grandfather was living in Connecticut at the time. He had migrated years ago, way before I did, working. And so when I was born, my grandfather told my parents that they should come over here. And so we did, and then we stayed at my grandfather's house. And then he had to move back to Mexico, and so we just stayed. The plan was to never, I think when you're undocumented, or you're an immigrant in general, right, the plan is to never stay here forever. The plan is to stay here, work for a couple of years, save up money to build a house in Mexico or back where you're from, and then go back. And that was my parents' plan, right? That was their plan. Their plan was to stay here for 5 years, work, save up money, buy a piece of land in Mexico, and then go back, but that never happened. And so we stayed here, grew up, went through the whole K-12 education public school system. And then it wasn't until my senior year of high school where I realized that I was undocumented. I mean, I kind of always known. I always knew that I was undocumented, but I don't think I never really knew how to put it into words or what the term was. I remember in eighth grade, there was a field trip to Disney World. There was an eighth grade field trip to Disney World in Florida. And this was way before any policy was passed. This was way before DACA was passed or anything like that. And when my class was going and there was a whole permission slip that my parents had to sign and stuff, I remember going home, explaining, so super excited to my, going home, telling my parents that I was going to go to Disney World and stuff. And they were like, oh, well, how are you going to go? How is your school plan going? And then I said, through plane. And they go, well, I don't think you can go because you're different than your other classmates. And I said, what do you mean? And they're like, well, your friends and your classmates have different passports than you do, and so because of that, you can't really get on a plane. Because if you get on a plane, you probably won't be able to come back. And I was super confused at that time. Obviously, they weren't telling me, what the situation was or nothing.
How old were you at the time?
I was in eighth grade.
Eighth grade.
So I was, 12 years old? And I was like, all right. So I was really upset. I didn't end up going. Everyone went. My teachers were asking me why can't I go, and stuff. And so I just told them that my parents just told me that I can't. And so of course, growing up, I'm like, okay, realizing that they were scared because when you're undocumented, without any documentation or any, if you don't have an ID, a U.S. passport or a driver's license or a state ID, then it's gonna be really hard for you to get through TSA and security, because depending on what state you're from, too. So they were scared that if I was going to go to Disney World, then I probably wouldn't have gone past TSA, or they would have asked me for my legal documentation that I don't have, especially when I was in eighth grade. And so yeah, so that happened. And, you know, I kind of just knew that I was different after that. That it was just, like, you know, undocumented. But, you know, it wasn't until my senior year of high school where I really, like, okay, applying to colleges and applying to financial aid and realizing that I can't get financial aid. And I just remember being so mad. Like, I was a really good student. I fulfilled the dreamer narrative, which is, you know, being top of your class or being straight-A student. I was that. I was that because my parents always told me to be that. And so when that happened, you know, usually most undocumented students don't find out they're undocumented till they're applying to college. And when I got, I remember being going back home and being so pissed off, and I remember just yelling at my mom, saying, just yelling at her the most horrible things that I ever could have said to her. I pretty much I took my frustration out on her, and it wasn't fair for her, because I told her just, like, I yelled at her things like, what do you say? Like, why couldn't you wait for me to be born here? Why didn't you bring me here why couldn't you wait, right? Like, why couldn't you wait? Like, if you would have waited and, you know, if I was born here, I wouldn't have to be going through this situation right now. And the possibility of me going to college was, like, very low. After that happened, I felt really bad, and I analyzed, and I was like, no, this is not my mom's fault. This is, like, you know, the laws in place is what prevents me from being able to go to college and from, you know, having that pathway to citizenship. I applied to UConn as a music education major because I had been in the music world for, like, 10 years. I played clarinet for 10 years, and so I wanted to become a teacher in music because I like teaching. I like giving private lessons to students. I got in. I got into UConn, and the music department gave me a scholarship, a really big scholarship. And I, through the help of other scholarships that I applied to, I was able to come to UConn. After I came to UConn, it was just, you know, very different, super different. I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut, where it's just super, super diverse, predominantly black and brown population. And coming up here was predominantly white, predominantly white institution. And so coming up here was like, okay, this is not, I feel like I didn't belong here. And when you're undocumented, not only am I brown, not only am I Latina, but I'm also undocumented. So when I was here, I got here my freshman year, I was like, oh shit, this is way different. it was just, I felt very alone, very, very alone. Yes, I did have friends, yes, I was able to make friends and stuff, but it's not the same as sharing your experiences as being undocumented to other people. Navigating white spaces and navigating my status was really tough for me in my freshman year. And to this day, right? But definitely my freshman year, I had a hard time. I went to a meeting where there was this, my friend named Eric Cruz Lopez, who I didn't know at the time, and he was just a random person. It was actually a church. It was so funny. I actually met him at church. I went to church, and I met him there. And we would always... He's also brown. He's also Mexican. So, you know, we're never on time for mass. We're just never on time. So we have to always stand up on the back of the church because everyone, you know, there wouldn't be no seats left. So I remember standing next to him. And just, you know, we were the only brown people in the room. Everyone's white. And it was a Catholic church, so... everyone's white. And I don't know, it was something like between, like, we just felt comfortable and saying hi to each other and introducing to ourselves to each other. And I don't know what it was about me that I felt so comfortable, or I don't know, I was like waiting for the moment to tell someone that I was undocumented. And I told him that when I introduced myself to him, I was like, hi, I'm Jocelyn and stuff. And he asked me what year I am and stuff. And then I'm like, okay, I'm a freshman, and then I'm also undocumented. And coincidentally, he said, oh shit, I'm undocumented too. So what are the odds, right? What are the odds? And so after that, we just both connected and talked And he told me that he was involved in this organization called Connecticut Students for a Dream. And that organization is a state organization that led by undocumented youth, that advocates for undocumented youth and, you know, their rights and their families. And he asked if I was, if I would, you know, like to go to a meeting, and be a part of what they're doing, with the work they're doing and stuff. And I was like, oh my God, yes, like, I'll be down. Went to a meeting, in Hartford, which is like half an hour away from stores. And that was like the first time where I really was in a room full of other undocumented students that were also in college and high school, and sharing the similar experiences of being left, feeling like left out, feeling alone, and stuff, and that was the first time where I felt so comfortable, very comfortable and like at home, and you know, being an hour away from home from my parents was tough, and so I just needed that. I really needed that, and after that, that's when I really got involved. For the past four or five years, they were fighting for institutional aid, which would allow undocumented students to have access to institutional aid. As you know, there are states like California, Texas, what's it called, state of Washington, and a couple other states down in the West Coast that give financial aid or some type of aid to undocumented students. And C4D, Connecticut Students for a Dream, they wanted to pass that law here for in Connecticut. And so that's what, you know, they told me about it, and I was like, yeah, sure, like, yes, that affects me, and I would want to get some type of aid, too. So ever since then, I got involved my freshman year. And then I switched my major to political science and human rights. And recently I switched to Latin American studies and human rights. So I switched my major like 3 times. but yeah, so that's, I don't know, I guess that's how my upbringing came up. Getting involved and meeting some really dope organizers and activists. Yeah, I don't know.
So I previously, on like a previous episode, I had someone, I also tell her undocumented story, Paola Villatoro, shout out to her. And during her kind of upbringing and her story, she mentions how she was very fearful of telling people that she was undocumented, and like how when she reflected back on her life, she kind of noticed like that her upbringing was very different to her peers, whether it was because she was Latino or undocumented. Is this like the similar case for you?
So, the first time I remember telling my story or my status to someone was my senior year in high school when I was struggling on applying to, you know, financial aid and all these other things that I wasn't eligible for. I remember telling my music teacher that I was undocumented. And I was just so desperate to find help. And I told my parents, you know, about, you know, like, having the conversation with my parents about revealing my status, you know, was risky. They were scared for me, and I was scared too. Because they were scared for me, I was scared too. My parents definitely projected more of their fears to me, for me to even be scared to tell my story or my status. But I think if my parents weren't as scared, for me to review my status, I think I would have been fine. I think I would have felt less scary less scared about revealing my status. But because they were just like, oh my God, like, you have to watch out who you're telling your status to. What if your teacher could be racist, or you know might call immigration or ICE? You know, like, it's just a lot of these theories that was going through their minds and their heads. But at that point, I was like, you know what, Mom, I'm really trying to go to college. That's the reason why you two crossed for me, was in the first place, was for so I could attend college and have a better life than that they didn't have back in Mexico. So I was just, you know what, fuck it. I'm gonna tell my story to status and to someone because I need help, and then I wanna do this. You know, I didn't just work hard for nothing and then just give it up. So I told my music teacher about my status, and when I told him, I started crying. I was just, I broke down. I broke down. I broke down in front of everyone, my whole band, my band class, because I was in band when that happened. And he goes, oh. So he didn't know how to help me. He didn't know how to react, because I think this is where the education system lacks, on training teachers or educators on how to deal with situations like this, especially with undocumented students, when they're trying to help or when they want to help undocumented students. I feel like the public school system does a really shitty job on even helping training educators to help students of color in general, right? But specifically, you know, in this topic of being how do you help an undocumented student? How do you help, you know, one of your students who's undocumented to apply for college and stuff like that? And how should they react? So he didn't know how to react. He didn't know what to say, because he just never had that issue, or never. I was the first student to ever tell him that I was undocumented. And so he kind of just led me to the guidance counselor, the school guidance counselor, for her to then help me. And thankfully, she did have a little bit much more training on that, but still not knowledgeable enough that I had to be the one to go do my own research on what colleges I can apply to, realistically what I can afford and what I can't. And at first, you know, my guidance counselor was telling me to go to a community college. And I'm like, well, you know, community colleges are great and stuff, but, like, I want to go for music education. And so community colleges don't offer music education programs because they're very intense. Realistically, like, I would have liked to go to a four-year college. And so then my guidance counselor was like, yeah, but, you know, I don't think you can afford that right now. I don't think you could afford UConn right now or something like that. Because UConn has a really good music education program in the state. And, you know, that's why I wanted to come here in the first place. So it was just, I don't know, it was just a lot. It was just a lot of me having to reveal my status multiple times to multiple people and educators. For me to even find some type of help and some answers, because I just wasn't getting any. and if I was getting answers, it wasn't the answers that I wanted. Right, like I remember going up to one teacher, actually, who told me that I just can't go to college at all. And I was like, what? I was like, are you kidding me? Like, all right, whatever, you know, whatever. I'm going to let it slide. I'm going to walk away. And so just telling my parents this, they were so scared. They were just scared about me telling my status and just me talking in general. And so when I got involved with C4D, they were even much more scared, especially my mom. She was mad. My mom was so mad. She was so mad at me. I remember going home and telling her how I was getting involved and talking to my, revealing my status to everyone. And she was pissed off. She was just like, and I think her anger was more about coming from a place of just her being worried. But she just handled it in the wrong way, I think. And she told me to not get involved at all. Because, you know, what about us? Right? Because at this, because I do have DACA, thankfully. I am a DACA recipient. So in some type of way, I do have some type of protection. And my parents don't. And, you know, she says, you have DACA, so you're fine, but we don't. So if you talk about your status a lot, like, what's going to happen to us? What if one day, you know, someone decides to, who doesn't like you, or, you know, because of the work that you're doing or because you're undocumented, attempts to call immigration on us and stuff like that, and we just get deported? And I said, Mom, if that day were to ever happen, thankfully I have the resources and I know people that would be able to help fight that. And so she was just very worried. She was very, very worried. My dad was too, but I'm just the type of person that I'm going to do whatever I want to do because I just can. and then my mom, like, figured that out eventually when she still saw me get involved and organize protests and go to rallies. Like, she knew that at this point, even if she did tell me to not go or not do this and that, I'm still going to do it. Because I told her, I said, Mom, if I'm trying to get help, right, if I'm trying to even graduate college or UConn, I'm going to need to talk to people to help me out throughout the way.
So you mentioned that DACA provides certain protections for those who are recipients. Can you kind of explain that for those who might not know?
So DACA is executive order that was passed by Obama, but not, how do I say it? Obama didn't wake up one day, let's be real, right? Obama didn't wake up one day and was like, I'm going to pass DACA because it's going to protect undocumented youth and give them the right to be protected from deportation or give them the right to work for 2 years and such. He didn't wake up with that idea. I'm very blessed and thankful to know I have a couple of friends who, you know, they're so badass and so dope, who met with Obama face to face in the White House a couple years ago, and said, "You need to pass something. You need to pass an executive order. You have to. You could use your power of through executive order to pass some type of policy to protect undocumented youth." Because the reason why he even got to be president was because he got the Latino vote, and he had promised immigration reform. He had promised to pass that or to bring that up, and obviously that never happened. And my friends were like, you know, you promised, right? So you're going to have to comply with that promise and keep up with that promise. So this is what you can do, right? My friends were the one, and with the help of lawmakers and the help of other lawyers, were able to propose that idea of DACA. And that's when Obama and my friends gave him a deadline. And that deadline was, if you do not pass, if you have 2 weeks, 2 weeks or 2 months or something like that, to pass something through executive order. And then later on, the next month, you know, he announced it on June 15th, Obama announced DACA. So we need to stop giving credit to politicians we need to stop giving credit to politicians who just want to take all the credit for everything that they've done. But let's be real, DACA was a push by the undocumented immigrant rights movement. It was especially the youth movement. He didn't just, wake up and with the idea. So let's give credit to that. Let's give credit to my friends and the people that really pushed for that. So DACA, was passed, and this was my freshman year of high school when I was able to be eligible for it and apply for it, and I was able to get it, thankfully. I have many friends, though, who weren't eligible for it. To this day, are still not eligible for it and go through a lot because of not having DACA. So many people were left out, right? I'm very privileged in that aspect that I do have some type of protection that my parents don't. My parents and my friends don't. And with DACA, I could work legally for 2 years and have to it's a renewal process. I have to renew every 2 years. But the thing is that it comes with a fee, and so it's like $495 to renew your DACA, not including, the lawyer, if you do have a lawyer, which is like more than a grand right there. That happened, but DACA was announced, was rescinded last September, September 5th, when Jeff Sessions announced, the removal of DACA. And that was, one of the promises that Trump, or 45, had said in his campaign, that if he were to become president, he would remove DACA. And that's exactly what he did. And so right now we're in a state of limbo, meaning that DACA is still in place, but for those who want to apply, who are eligible to apply for DACA and qualify for DACA, can't apply. So, it's really we're in a state of limbo of not knowing what, if it's still going to be continue or not, because there needs to be a judge ruling soon. I'm not sure when, because they're not announcing it when, whether it stays or not, whether DACA remains in place or not. So, does that explain?
Yeah, that explains it.
Okay, that's good.
So you kind of mentioned the current political climate. Can you talk about how the current president's kind of rhetoric might be effective to you, might be affect you and, like, those that are similar to you in your situation?
So when DACA was announced that it was removed on September 5th, it was the first week of classes. It was the first week of classes, and I was in class. I was in my poli sci class, my political science class, and I was just, you know, up on my laptop and watching Facebook Live, and then waiting for the announcement to happen. And I was actually asked from C4D, from the organization, to go down to DC that day, but I didn't want to miss class because it was the first week of classes, and I didn't want to fuck up already. So I decided to stay. Just probably I regret doing, because when that announcement happened, and I remember seeing Jeff Sessions announce that it was going to be removed, I walked out of class. I said, fuck this, walked out in front of a really big class, and so it was just weird, it was awkward. Everyone was looking at me like, what the fuck, why is she leaving? Why is she walking out? I walked out of class, and I didn't know where to go. I just knew that I didn't want to be on campus. I knew I didn't want to be here. And I came to the Puerto Rican and Latin American Culture Center. And I just remember walking inside and just broke down. I broke down. I really did. Before September, though, I was going through a lot already mentally and emotionally, and so just having the announcement of DACA being removed definitely hit me at my lowest. It really did. I just cried so much. And there were many people who were there, like the director of PERLAC of the Cultural Center, Fanny, was there for me, and many of my friends were there, but they were not undocumented. And so that's different. It's different when you're with a group of people who you can share the same pain with and the same remorse and anger with than being with people who, want to support you and want to be there for you, but unfortunately just can't share that experience. So I, was totally upset, and at that moment I called Eric, which is, the person who even got me involved in the first place. I called him. He was in D.C. He picked up, and, I was just like, what the fuck? Wow, this really just happened. And we both cried. And he cried too. He cried. I think we need to, men cry too, right? To stigmatize them and don't cry because they do. And he cried with me, and he goes, we both were just like, damn, without words, but, we're still on the phone. And that day, I remember my friends from Eastern Connecticut State University, which is the school right next to UConn, 15 minutes away from UConn, she told me that they were having a rally. Her and a couple of other undocumented students on campus were having a rally. And if I wanted to go. So I did. I took an Uber or something and went to the rally and was there with her and my friend Yenny. Shout out to her. For organizing that rally last minute. And I went, and, I was still in shock. We were all in shock. I think we were just, some people were crying, some were still in shock like me. Took our anger out and frustration out on people. Not on people, but I'm saying, through talking and through just chanting and all that stuff, which is what I needed to do. And after that, I called one of my friends from back home, and I said, can you pick me up, please? I really can't be at school right now. I really don't want to be at school right now. I want to be home. I want to be with my mom and my dad, my brothers. I have two younger siblings. And I want to cry with them. And so yeah, he picked me up, drove all the way up here, and drove all the way back to New Haven, 45 minutes away from UConn, and I went home. I got home, and, you know, saw my mom and my dad cry, and we all cried together, and, you know, I think being with them is what I needed to do, right? My dad was like, you got this. My dad was just like, they were trying to encourage me, and because I remember just going home that day, and I said, yeah, I don't think I want to be continue school. I was just like, what's the whole point of me continuing school if I can't even, use my degree after I graduate? Because, with removing DACA means that after your renewal, after your 2-year work permit expires, you can no longer renew it. And I was just upset and mad, and I was just like, what's the whole point of me continuing school, continuing UConn, and paying so much out of pocket if I can't even fucking use my degree after, and my parents were like, no, you need to stay because, you worked so hard to even be at UConn and continue to stay, and such, and so I think the only reason why I came back to school was because they wanted me to, and not because I wanted to. At that point, I didn't have any energy, any motivation. I really did not. The next day happened. There was a space, a healing space, at the Culture Center, that I had organized. And just went there, and many people were there to support and stuff. But still, it's just, it's hard when you're undocumented and you're still not in a place where you feel comfortable on telling your story or revealing your status that you are undocumented. Because I remember just, I was the only undocumented student in that space. And I did see other students who were there too, who I've never seen before, who probably were undocumented. But maybe they were just scared to even share their status with me or with others, and in front of a group of people, a good amount. It was packed. That room was packed that day. Everyone trying to help and stuff. So I did feel lonely, and I had to pull through. I don't know. I kind of like slipped away from the question a little bit, but I was.
Oh, it's fine.
Yeah.
So you kind of touched upon mental health and how it affects many people, but especially for you who has so many different intersectionalities, can you kind of speak about mental health and kind of how your mental health can affect you depending on your intersectionalities?
What was the number? I think on average, the average woman has a 25% level of with anxiety or depression, but when you're undocumented, that number increases, and I think it's up to 45-ish or more percent of living with anxiety and depression. Last spring, I went through something rough. It was, fairly traumatic, physically and emotionally. And when that happened, thankfully, I had people surrounding me who wanted to support me. I had a meeting with the director of Dean of Students, the director of Student Health Services, and the director of Counseling Mental Health Services at UConn. And they were all there in the room, sitting down with me, and I'm telling them my situation, what's going on, and what's happening to me right now. And telling them that, I don't want to drop out. I don't want to drop out. I want to be able to, but I know that after this process, I'm going to need a lot of help and support. So that day, after that meeting, mind you, I've never had therapy. I've never had any sort of, of the thought or even therapy never came up, because it's just one not talked about in our household, especially in the Latinx household. Or especially in a family where my parents never had access to those resources back home in Mexico. because they were just so poor. You know, the thought of therapy is just like, you know, it was really, you know, my parents, for them to think that for me to get therapy is like, I have to be really like going through something really rough for me to even do that. Which I was, which I did. In that meeting, the director of the counseling mental health services came up to me. She said, I want to take you in. You need to see me. You need to see someone, and I want to be able to see you. So make an appointment with me on this day and this time. And I was like, yeah, sure. I was like, sure. You know, I'll give it a shot. And she goes, yeah, I want to make sure that you're able to get the support that you need right now that you're going to go through. I was like, okay. And so thankfully, you know, before that meeting even happened, sorry, a little backtrack, me and the director of CMHS, Counseling Mental Health Services, me and Betsy had met up before to talk about giving free services, free mental health services to undocumented students because, one, you know, we don't have access to health insurance. I don't have health insurance. Having access to health insurance when you're undocumented in general is so hard. It's just not, it's pretty much non-existent unless you have an employer who provides that, provides insurance for you. And I don't have any of that at the moment. I definitely did not have any of that. And so I talked to Betsy about giving free services to students who are undocumented, who reveal their status, who want to seek therapy, who want to seek help, if they could provide free services. And so she was totally for it, totally about it. And so, you know, thankfully when she did tell me that she would take me in, I wasn't worried. Thankfully I had the privilege of not worrying about me paying some type of fee. And so I saw her and we talked and it was interesting. it was weird because I found it weird. I was just like, wow, this is my first session. I've never been in therapy, you know, debunking myths of therapy really is just, important because, you know, it's not talked about in our household. It wasn't talked about to me. My parents definitely did not talk to me about seeking help or mental health or anything like that. And when I told my parents that I was seeing therapy later on, they were kind of just like, what do you need that for? Like, why are you seeing therapy? Like, what's going on? What's going on? What happened to you? And I said, I told them, I'm not comfortable on telling you right now because I just need my own privacy too, right? But just know that I'm going through something rough and I want to see therapy. And Betsy was really, she's really great. I'm still seeing her to this day. She's really great, thankfully, super supportive, and such. And so, my mom, I remember when I told my mom about, like, therapy and stuff, and she goes, why do you need that? You don't need that. Like, we've been through worse in Mexico. We've been through worse than you. Why are you over here, you know, saying therapy? You don't need it. And I said, okay. I said, all right, yes, valid. You've been through worse. You've been through worse. You and Dad have been through worse. I'm not going to invalidate your experiences, but I'm also not going to let you invalidate mine because you don't even know what I'm going through right now, and I don't feel comfortable telling you, so I'm just not going to, and I'm going to continue seeing therapy, whether you like it or not. And, you know, she kind of didn't say anything after that. She just let me do my own thing. And yeah, so I continued seeing therapy and such because I, you know, had a rough time and was diagnosed with depression and anxiety, and that was rough because I remember one week of April, of last spring, where I just could not leave my room. I wasn't eating. I was eating once a day or barely. I didn't want to get out of bed. It was raining too every day for that week, and so it was just not helpful at all. And even though I had many people like telling me to text me to leave or to go out to eat for lunch or dinner and such, I just made an excuse and said I was doing homework or I was busy. But the reality was that I was just in bed, laying there, not doing anything, and just depressed, and not wanting to do anything. And there were moments after that where I contemplated suicide. there were two moments where I did contemplate suicide. And I was close. I was close in doing it. I was close. And when that happened, that's when I knew I had to really, I had to call my therapist on her own personal cell phone. And I said, Betsy, like, please help me talk me out of this situation right now because, you know, yeah. And she was there. She picked up and she talked to me and she gave me a whole consult and such. And yeah, and, you know, she helped me pull through. I took that semester, I took incompletes, meaning that I had requested for all my classes to take take time off of classes and finish completing their work in the summer, which is what I did. I completed their work in the summer, and I did that and turned it all in, and I got a good grade and didn't get penalized for it because I had a valid reason on why I asked for that request. It was for mental health purposes. And you know, I was working my way through that depression. I wasn't taking medication at the time because I was scared to do it. I was scared to get on it because, you know, I was just like, yeah, I didn't want to get to that point. But again, when DACA got removed, I didn't think it would affect me a lot as it really did, and it did. Just when I was working my way up through and working my way to recovery, DACA happened and got removed. And again, went back to a really bad depressive state, and it was really bad. And top of that, I had other personal things going on at the same time after DACA got removed, where to the point where my therapist Betsy was like, "Yeah, I think we should start exploring this option of you taking medication now." And when she mentioned that, it's because, you know, she never really mentioned that before. And when I know that she mentioned that, I was like, yeah, it's time. I should. So I did get on medication. I was taking Wellbutrin, which helps for anxiety and depression. I was taking Wellbutrin, and it was the best decision I made. I'm not going to lie. It was. I was scared. Of course, I was scared. And when I took them, I was taking them. I didn't tell my parents about it, but I did bring up the idea to them. And I remember going back home one weekend and just being like, Mom, you know, my therapist was talking about me getting on medication. Meanwhile, right, like, I'm already doing it, I'm already taking it, but I just wanted to see how she would react or her thoughts would be on me taking medication. And I said, Mom, you know, like, my therapist recommended me to start taking medication and such. And she goes, She was just an utter shock. Like, she was just didn't know what to say at that moment. And she was like, you know, I guess she was trying to be as supportive as she could be, but she just didn't, she didn't go about it in the right way as I wanted to. She basically told me no. That she didn't think it was a good idea. Because what if it's going to, like, mess up with your mental health even more, or the side effects, like, you know, which are very valid, you know, fears. Side effects could go two ways. And she goes, yeah, like, pretty much called me really crazy, for even thinking about that medication. And I'm like, yeah, well, that's the point, Mom. So I'm trying to be better. I'm trying to be a better person and feel better because I'm not in a good place right now. And, you know, she was just like diminishing my reasons, and she said, it's all in your head, it's all mental, like, you know, just pray to God or something, go to church, just do a couple prayers, and you'll be fine. I'm like, Mom, that's not how this works. That's not how mental health works, because if I did that, right, trust me, I don't want to be depressed, right? And I told her, I said, you're really thinking right now that I want to be depressed? Like, no, it's not what I want. I want to be out of that depression mode and be how I used to be, and stuff. But, you know, eventually, at the end of the conversation, I did tell her. I was like, Mom, guess what? I'm already on them, so you can't tell me shit. And she goes, all right. She was like, all right. She was like, este pendejo, ya. Y lo frego. But eventually she did get supportive, eventually. It took a while. And that's when I learned that you can't really meet people where you want them to meet or where you want them you to meet. You have to meet them at where they're at. And that's what I had to do. And that's what she had to do too, right, with me. I don't know. It was a tough ride because I did get my dose increased after a while, and I felt very flat, and it just wasn't feeling right. And I told my therapist about it and my psychiatrist, and so they lowered the dose. It took a while. Basically, what I'm trying to say is it took a while for me to get adjusted to my medication. I took it for a year, or almost a year, and I got off of them beginning of the summer, actually. And thankfully, I'm not on them anymore. I'm at a way better place right now, through the help of my therapist, the medication, my friends, my professors. My professors have helped me so much and have been there for me throughout my lowest moments. And eventually my parents did end up supporting me too on that. So it was a rough ride, but here I am. I'm still here. It's been tough because when you're undocumented, and only 1-3% of undocumented students nationally graduate college. Only 1-3%. That's undergrad, right? That's a very low number. And hopefully, I'm a senior now, and hopefully I should be part of that percent. So trying to get my way through that is rough. Living with depression is rough, and anxiety, and being undocumented, and then being brown, and being Latina. There's so much misogyny going on, and always getting catcalls at a time, and such and such. But yeah, I don't know. That's my experience on mental health, right there.
Well, first off, thank you for sharing your a story that's very personal and a powerful story that many people probably wouldn't want to share. So thank you for coming and sharing your story. I also realized while you were talking about it that you brought up a point that I found like a common theme when I speak to like people that are Latinx. Usually when they're talking about how they feel like they're going through something in life, and they try to speak to their parents often like downplay what they did. Mm-hmm. So they'll just be like, oh, I went through worse, so like why are you complaining? Mm-hmm. Like XYZ. So mm-hmm. I think it's like, unfortunately, it's the situation where the older generation or the parents are kind of like not fully understanding the implications and the life that comes along with being like, for example, a first generation person in the U.S. and what they face, because their intersectionalities are different. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important. You also mentioned prior to this that you wanted to come on specifically during this week to talk about mental health, now that it's Mental Health Awareness Week. So I appreciate again that you came on and shared your story and kind of showing people different outlets or different ways that they could possibly attack, or not attack, but take on their mental health and like how different avenues are available for people. Mm-hmm. So thank you for coming on and sharing about that. But you're a very active person, especially in the communities that you're a part of, and you also do advocacy work for Planned Parenthood. Can you kind of speak upon Planned Parenthood a little bit, like give like a general synopsis of exactly what it is?
Yes, so Planned Parenthood is a nonprofit who is constantly aiming and working towards advocating for reproductive health, right, women's rights, and LGBTQIA+ community too. Planned Parenthood provides so much services that need to be provided, especially for communities of color. My job is to advocate for and educate the Latinx community on Planned Parenthood and, what services we have to offer, but also the many things that we have done in policy and law, also in the communities too. Like, for example, when many people think of Planned Parenthood, they think about abortions and how that's the only thing that Planned Parenthood provides. And it's not. Planned Parenthood is a great clinic that provides what's it called? Breast cancer screenings, STD exams, and so much many other more services. Improvised birth control. Hello. Birth control is great. We need that. I'm definitely on birth control. And, you know, as someone who's undocumented and doesn't have health insurance, I could go to Planned Parenthood and go to a clinic there and be seen by a doctor and get checked for such a low, low price that I can't do in any other clinics. And so shout out to Planned Parenthood, because now that I'm an employee, for the first time ever in my life, am I able to experience free care at the clinic. So, for example, if I were to get an STD test exam or birth control or any other services by Planned Parenthood, I could go there for free and get checked, and then, or if I'm, even if I'm sick, or if they could give me antibiotics and such like that, and all for free. And I was never able to do that way before, before at all. I remember one time being really sick last year, really, really sick. Nothing was helping me. Nothing at all was helping me at all. And whatever I bought at the pharmacy was just not helping me at all. I had to take the risk and go to student health, the infirmary and student health services at UConn. And just that one visit, it was a flu visit. I had the flu. I was charged more than $150 for that one visit. It was a 15-minute consult too, 15 minutes. I was charged more than $150, and I was like, what? It's like, oh my god, this is a lot. So much, just for a fucking flu visit, and so I had to pay out of pocket for that, and that was a lot. I remember telling my parents, like, they were like, what, like, why didn't you buy anything from the pharmacy, this and that? I'm like, I know, I tried, but nothing was working, and, you know, so now that I'm working for Planned Parenthood, I'm able to get seen for free, and get all the services, most of the services provided for free, and such, and it's such a privilege. It's a really great privilege. I'm like, oh my god, and it feels different, and it sucks, right? Because I think that access to healthcare should be free, and should be accessible, but it's not. And ironically, in a country where many people, you know, look up to or whatever, doesn't have access to care for free or any of that is complete bullshit. It's complete bullshit and it sucks. But thankfully for Planned Parenthood, we do provide these services and have clinics where they can provide these services for very low cost or for free, especially to low-income communities of color. And so right now I'm trying to educate the community how, you know, reproductive health is healthcare, right? Abortions are healthcare. We need to start destigmatizing abortions and such, because it does affect women. It does affect people who go through it in a negative way. And so Planned Parenthood, you know, is the clinic that is constantly being attacked, especially under 45, now that Kavanaugh got nominated for Supreme Justice. We're very concerned. My job is on the line. A lot of patients and their rights are on the line, especially having access to birth control, you know, even such that is at risk. It's all at risk now. And it always was. It's always been at risk, especially like states like Texas and the very conservative states down in the South who have laws in place that prevent or make it really hard for women to have access to reproductive services, because birth control is considered an abortion service, and condoms are considered also another form of abortions. And anyways, you know, states like that, like Texas, have policies that say that give women a hard time to have access to these things. So Planned Parenthood has always been attacked and is always constantly under attack, but now especially more. Under Kavanaugh being nominated and confirmed, my job is on the line, and the right to have access to reproductive health is on the line. It's all on the line right now. Really, closer now than it's ever been, because he wants to overturn Roe v. Wade, and that's gonna be an interesting case to do. But yeah, Planned Parenthood is great. Please go to Planned Parenthood if you need some access to STD screenings or testing. Like, it's great. It's definitely opened a lot of doors for me that I didn't have before. And working for them is just awesome. My coworkers are so supportive. They're queer. They're super gay and super, super queer and very proud of it. And, you know, they don't give two fucks. They've definitely moved their way out to help their patients and to help their the people that they're helping for, they're working for. So, yeah.
All right. Well, is there any last words that you want to leave the people with, advice or something that you want to plug in?
If you have the privilege to go vote, go vote. and do your research, because, you know, we're telling people to go vote and vote and vote, but we're not telling people who to vote for and how do you navigate your ways to finding out how to vote and who to vote for. So there are organizations that help help do that, help you apply to register to vote, especially if you're, you know, if you speak more than one language or a Spanish speaker or have another language that and not English. What's it called? And if you have the privilege to, because it is a privilege, I'm going to admit, I forgot to admit, I am very privileged to even have access to therapy for free. You know, and so, but if, you know, if you do have a privilege to go seek therapy, you should. Highly encourage it. It's great. It's amazing. My therapist has helped me out throughout so much, and if it weren't for my therapist and a couple other resources, I wouldn't be here right now. I really, very, and this is very transparent, I really would not be here right now. So, yeah, therapy's great. It's okay to not be okay. I've learned that. It's okay to not be okay. Because, you know, and take care of yourself, because my therapist was told me one time that, you know, and she put this analogy of a motor engine, how if you're constantly, you know, pressing the gas pedal all the time and you're not cleaning the motor engine enough, it's going to eventually break down and you're going to be stranded in the middle of nowhere. And you're going to be feeling very useless and feeling very lonely. And so, I don't know, clean that motor engine, I guess. Take care of it. So yeah.
Well, I appreciate you coming on, you sharing your stories, your experiences, and the advice that you have for people. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
The podcast you just heard was published with Anchor. Got something you want to say to the creator of this show? Send them a voice message using the Anchor app, free for iOS and Android.